You're listening to The Impromptu on the Hologram Radio Network, a multifaceted show discussing how technology, art, design, and equality converge on topics that matter most to us. From gaming culture to film and other forms of media, we examine the creative process and how the decisions we make shape our perceptions and lives. I'm Alex Knight, and I'm joined by Michael Norton, Chief Creative Officer. How are you, Michael?
Pretty good.
Oh, judging by the quality of your voice, it looks like you're sitting right in front of me.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing.
Well, this week it seems like a lot of the focus has been on Nintendo's first iOS app that has finally... See, I'm so excited I'm losing my voice. Nintendo's launched a new app called Miitomo. I hope I pronounced that correctly.
Yep.
So, why don't you tell me what this app is about and what it's supposed to do? I have spent some time setting it up, and I do have some things to say about that. But I'll let you start.
So, it's basically a social network where you create your Mii, which is tied to your Nintendo account. They've overhauled their entire account system, and now you just have one Nintendo account across Wii U, 3DS, and obviously the NX, which, if you believe the rumors, and I do, is coming out this fall. And Miitomo is like, it's kind of like the 3DS game Tomodachi Life a little bit. Your Miis will basically talk to each other and visit with each other. And instead of a traditional social network where you make posts or submit media or whatever.
Yeah.
Miitomo is a little more passive. You kind of answer questions that your Mii asks you, like, how was your day, or what's going on, or what's your favorite food, or what's your favorite color? Like, it'll just randomly ask you these questions. And the news feed, quote unquote, of the app is basically answers that the people on your friends list have given to various questions. So it's kind of a way to find out more about the people in your life. If you don't know certain people particularly well, like maybe people on your Twitter list, it kind of provides a way for you to learn more about them and for them to learn more about you. And I mean, it's kind of, it's cutesy. It's very bubblegum. Like it's not like hard hitting, like,
no,
when did you last experience racism? Like it doesn't ask hard questions.
Well, let's talk about the cutesy design aspect. Do you think that the way it was designed with these kind of cutesy avatars representing yourself and other people, that it makes the environment a little more comfortable to, like you said, get to know people? Because I always feel, even on Twitter too, most of the time people tend to use pictures of themselves.
Yeah.
But I don't know about you, but sometimes I do feel slightly self-conscious, and I definitely at least give a passing thought to what I'm about to say to everybody, or what I'm about to say to an individual when I reply to them. But it just seems like maybe that the sort of cutesy animated factor of that might make it a little bit more playful and maybe allow somebody to feel more comfortable.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a really clever emotional design by creating these facsimiles of yourself that are cartoonish, that are kind of adorable. And it follows through in kind of the animations that they have and the expressions they have. Like, they'll do things like scrunch up their faces and like wave their arms back and forth like they're so happy, and like flowers will burst out, like very anime ridiculous kind of stuff. And by creating a social network that's basically all that all the time, you're effectively preventing harassment and the kinds of negative things that occur on Twitter and Facebook, because you basically have no choice other than to post positive things. There's no way you can attack someone. I mean, sure, you could have a really terrible answer to a question, but it's not directed at anyone per se. Like, got to invoke Godwin's law here. I mean, you could answer a question with Hitler did nothing wrong or something, right? And that would be terrible, but it's not at the same level of vitriol that can be found on Twitter. Like, yeah. There's no direct communication system to be like, hey, you go die. I hate you. You're terrible, et cetera, et cetera. Like, there's simply no means to do it in Mitomo. So it's all been very carefully, deliberately designed to be as positive as possible.
Yeah, and that makes sense. I mean, by having that very constraint, I mean, because that limits you so much, then, yeah, of course, that's could potentially, or I guess it will, prevent a lot of abuse.
Yeah.
Which is what Nintendo is going for, I think, because they tend to be more family-focused, I think, than...
Yeah.
Than other companies. Certainly more than PlayStation, I think.
Which, of course, can be a detriment, as we saw a day or two ago with their firing of Allison Rapp, who was besieged by Gamergate. Rather than invite scandal or cause any sort of attention by standing up for her, they basically just fired her to avoid any kind of PR mess for the company, essentially. Like, they basically wanted to just throw the whole thing to the wolves. Now, they claim that...
Well, hold on a sec, because I think we're putting the cart before the horse here, because let's explain to people what this is about, because I certainly have...
Right.
I don't know much about this, because I only heard about this yesterday, and I haven't spent the time to research it. So what exactly happened?
Okay, so... There was a woman working at Nintendo's Treehouse team, which is their localization team that takes games that are released in Japan and makes them ready for the North American market. And that can include things like translating jokes to something that makes more sense in English, because Japanese cultural stuff is very different. Like, there are jokes or sayings that don't translate, so you have to come up with something different. And in some cases, it can mean content censorship. Like, Japan has a very, I would say, warped view of sexuality. Everything is very misogynistic. It's very directed at these sexualized, almost teenage girls. And more often than not, a lot of that content has to be expunged for North American audiences or European audiences. Because in Japan, like, some of that stuff is kind of acceptable, sort of, but... In North America and Europe, it just isn't. Like, they had I'll give you an example, Xenoblade Chronicles X for Wii U, they had a female character that looked almost prepubescent, and it included a boob slider.
Because of course it did.
Because of course. And the North American version removed the boob slider. You had no choice of boobs, which... is a sentence I have to say in 2016, because of course. Naturally, a lot of men were very upset by this. Men who are childish and basically demand that all female characters in games be sex objects for them to ogle. And they decided, because of this and... several other content things, such as Fire Emblem, when they removed that problematic plot line where you turned a lesbian character into being straight with a potion.
Yeah, I remember
they
that.
They ditched that entire thing, thankfully.
Yeah.
But that and the Xenoblade thing and several other changes that were made, these people got extremely pissed off and decided to single out and blame Allison Rapp. Now, Alison Rapp, she wasn't in charge of anything. She wasn't responsible for the decision-making that led to that content being expunged. She was just a member on the team. She didn't have the ability to go, I don't like this particular thing, let's get rid of it, period. Like, she did not have that power at all.
Okay.
She might have said, I feel that this is problematic because X, Y, and Z, and then the team discussed it, but ultimately the decision power was with somebody else. Probably a man, if we're being honest. And so, because there was a woman on the team, the Gamergate people basically decided to blame her for everything, and they started doxing her, pulling up a bunch of stuff from her past, and they found a paper that she wrote where she talked about some of these weird sexuality things in Japanese culture. And some of her viewpoints are a little shaky, but none of it was what I would consider inappropriate. Yet, Gamergate basically twisted the words in that paper and tried to claim successfully now, more or less, that Alison Rapp is a pedophile or supports pedophiles because of what's in that paper. But in no terms does she support pedophilia in that paper at all. She's just talking about a very specific quirk of Japanese culture.
Is this why people are claiming that she were these the grounds on dismissing her?
They
haven't made an official statement. We don't
they
really
did
know,
make an official statement.
Okay.
So Gamergate continued attacking her, continued dragging up things, throwing her name through the mud, asking Nintendo to fire her over and over and over and over and over again. Some of them, like, in fact, the white supremacist website, the Daily Stormer, a bunch of users from there actually phoned Nintendo pretending to be concerned parents that worried that she was adding pedophile propaganda to the game somehow. Like, a bunch of ridiculous, absurd crap. But because Nintendo is the company that they are, rather than go, you know what, we stand by our employee, we will not tolerate this harassment, they just wanted to sweep it under the rug as quickly as possible. So their official statement is that they fired her because she was moonlighting, working another job in her spare time. Alison Rapp claims that that was not disallowed at Nintendo, and I believe some former employees have actually come out and confirmed that that's the case. So Nintendo, even if that was the actual reason they fired her, ultimately, this is about Nintendo's silence and refusal to support women or support minorities against these harassers. They're basically throwing their hands to their ears and refusing to deal with the situation instead of attacking the problem like some other game companies have done. Another example, recently, Overwatch by Blizzard. They removed a problematic pose that one of the female characters had, where she was kind of exposing her butt, and she was wearing basically like latex underwear, and it was like totally accentuated. Like, the entire pose was basically this sexualized objectification. And in playtesting, they realized that it had to go. And the thing is, when you're playtesting a game, it's not just one comment from one person. It's not just, ooh, one person was offended, we're going to get rid of this now. Somebody makes a comment, then the team goes, huh, I hadn't thought of it that way. We should have discussions about this. Then they talk it over, think about, well, what is this really adding to the game? Is it really important that we have this? And they go, no, it isn't. So then ultimately they make the decision to pull the content because it serves no purpose and it just continues to perpetuate the culture that we're trying to.
Well, there's a double standard because, like, for me, I don't have a problem with nudity and sex in, or sexuality in general, but the problem that we see specifically staying on topic here with games is that there is this double standard because you don't see the male characters in these games making these sexy poses.
No. Never.
So because it's always one-sided, I mean, it's the this is stuff that's being done by men.
Yeah, for men.
So it's like you can't, you know, either all the characters do that, male and female.
Or none of them.
Or none of them.
Exactly.
You just can't have women being the only ones doing sexy poses.
Yeah, exactly. Give me some hot Ryu with the beard.
Does he have a beard now?
Well, there's this one skin for Ryu where he has a beard and he's all right. Like burly and it's like
I know there are a bunch of memes.
Oh yeah,
in the character. I don't know we got derailed from talking about the Miitomo app to this somehow.
Well, I feel like it was an important segue to make because a lot of people are conflicted about Miitomo because they're angry at Nintendo for this.
Right.
And yet,
oh yes. Okay.
Like this app comes out at the like basically the same day as this is happening and people are very conflicted about whether to support this or not because they don't know, well, should we boycott Nintendo? Should we?
That'll never happen.
Like,
did you see the app? Did you look at the app store? The top free apps, and the Miitomo app is at the top, and it has over 8,000 reviews.
Yeah.
I've never seen an app with that many reviews before.
Yeah, it's insane how well this app is doing.
And it's getting a positive response, too.
Everybody has it. Pretty much everybody has it. The question will be, does it have staying power? Like, everyone's downloading it and trying it out, but will people actually keep using it? That's the question. A lot of apps just fizzle out after a week.
Right. That remains to be seen. But I have no idea about that, but I don't think it's that well done as far as the app is concerned. My initial experience as someone who doesn't even have a Nintendo account, creating the account... you know what? A lot of this stuff, the positive note is that a lot of this stuff can be fixed. These are like onboarding UI things that could be fixed. Because when I first started the app, I get all these, you know, the like while things are loading, you get the hint screen that rotates with different messages. But when you first run the app, those hints are coming up and I'm trying to read them. But every time I'm getting another modal dialogue that covers it, that asks me every couple seconds to do something else in order to, and all these individual steps that I need to take to get set up. So it was a little annoying. But like I said, a lot of this stuff will be fixed and I'm sure they will continue to polish the app. And to be fair for Nintendo, this is their first iOS app. I think it's their first smartphone app, is it not?
Yeah, it's their first app, period.
So we'll cut them a little bit of slack there.
Yeah, it's early days for them, but it's definitely impressive what they've been able to do. So
now, as someone who doesn't have a Nintendo Wii, is there any use to this app? Like just using this app if you don't have a Nintendo console? Like,
well, I mean. Using it gives you coins that go towards the My Nintendo reward system that they just brought in. But of course, some of those rewards are downloadable games for 3DS or Wii U.
Right, so this is meant to be a companion app for Nintendo users, basically.
Pretty much,
I'm not the Nintendo target.
You get the maximum usage if you have a Nintendo console of some sort. And that'll probably, like, that sort of thing will probably deepen with the release of the NX. Like, I would think the NX... From the ground up, the OS running on there will basically be fully integrated with the Nintendo Network account stuff and the point system and everything.
Well, hopefully they have everything worked out by then.
Yeah. I mean, they're working with Dana on a lot of it, and they know what they're doing. So I think it'll turn out just fine. So far, it's been pretty good. I mean, the sign up page for the Nintendo Network crashed on day one, but since then it seemed pretty stable. And I've been going into my account periodically and looking at the new reward system and everything. Apparently they've also launched the Nintendo eShop on the web, so you can actually buy 3DS and Wii U games
from
your browser.
Wow.
Like every other console.
Welcome to the 21st century, Nintendo.
And and supposedly when you buy it, it will automatically download to your Wii U or 3DS if they're connected to Wi-Fi. Though that doesn't always work extremely well.
You know, I actually had those problems too. Now, it's been a long time since I've tried it, but PS4, using the PlayStation web app to buy games and download them, sometimes they would download to like one device, but not to the, like they would download to my PS4, but the PS Vita wouldn't pick it up. Or sometimes like nothing would happen and wouldn't trigger the downloads. I don't know what the hell is going on there, but
oh, that's weird.
Yeah. You would think in 2016, all of this stuff would be working smooth, but no.
It's pretty much too much to ask.
Yeah. So what else, I mean, overall, what's your general impression of this Miitomo app?
I think it's fun. I think it's neat, kind of interesting. Will I keep using it? I don't know. So far, I'm enjoying it.
Did they only release this on iOS, or is there an Android?
There's
version?
An Android version as well.
Okay,
so it's on both platforms. No word on Windows Phone.
Yeah, five people care about that.
Yeah, even Microsoft doesn't seem to care about Windows Phone these days either. They literally said at BuildConf this week that they're not focusing on Windows Phone this year.
Yeah, that is a telltale sign that platform's going to go away.
Yeah, if you have a Lumia, I would consider looking elsewhere soon.
Do you think the Lumias are going to be like the new Zune?
Probably.
A couple years from now? I mean,
probably. I think what could happen is that Nintendo. I think what Microsoft might do is release a Surface phone, and the Surface phone will be like a 6 or 7 inch phablet thing, and it'll run full Windows 10. It'll have like an Intel chip in it or something. I don't know. And you'll be able to dock it into a keyboard and monitor, and it'll work just like a regular Windows PC. Like all of their Continuum stuff will be fully realized, and it'll basically be this mini Windows PC
that actually sounds really cool.
You can
really
take
cool.
with you.
I remember
see them doing that.
That sounds a lot like what Ubuntu was trying to do with their mobile OS.
Yeah, exactly. So I think what we'll see is they'll kill the Lumia line and they'll bring out a Surface phone, and it'll basically be their flagship mobile device.
Yeah, but who's going to want to hold a 6-inch phone? That's not a phone.
I know.
That's not iPad mini territory.
My guess would be they'll focus on making it as comfortable to hold as possible. I mean, the Surface is quite comfortable for a tablet. I mean, obviously it's not as thin or as light as the iPad, but for something that has a full PC architecture inside, it does a pretty good job. So I would think that they'll be able to miniaturize it fairly decently. One of the key things I think on phones is reducing the bezel around the screen.
Oh, please.
That's kind of the big thing.
You know, it's interesting because I was looking at some of these newer Android phones now, as you know, manufacturers have steadily been reducing the bezel over the years, and it gave me confidence that future iPhones could really, like, even the 6S Plus,
yeah,
if you were to remove a lot of that bezel, that phone would be significantly more comfortable to hold.
Oh yeah. In fact, we I've done some sketch mock-ups using real dimensions, and if you shrank the bezels on a 6S Plus, it would effectively be as big as a 6S. Like, we're talking zero bezel and, well, not zero bezel, but like completely edge to edge, and then the top and bottom shrink a bit.
Because you still need space for the front-facing camera hardware.
You don't
and
need
the,
a lot
the
of space there, though. Not a lot.
So, well, then what's the holdup?
The home button.
The home button.
It's
so you take away
the home button.
So if you took away the home button, you would you still? What about this gap here? I'm for people that are listening here. I'm holding up an iPhone 6 and I'm pointing to the earpiece because there is about what is that like 1 or 2 centimeter gap between the top of the display and the actual speaker. So what is? I wonder what's in there. Like I've never cracked open an iPhone, so I don't know. What is taking up that space?
Well, a lot of that's, there's no space there really. Like everything behind the earpiece is behind the screen. Like it's directly behind the substrate. So,
right.
You could pretty easily move that and it wouldn't matter.
Yeah.
Like I honestly don't think the top part is the problem. It's the home button.
Do you think
it's
Apple would ever move the Touch ID thing to the back of the phone?
No. It's going to go inside the screen.
Inside the screen. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, that would be a whole new display technology. Is that another layer of
no,
something on top of the glass or what?
Yes. It would be an infrared layer inside the touch substrate that allows the screen to read a fingerprint. It's basically the exact same technology as the Touch ID sensor, just scaled up for the entire screen.
And in that case, folks, you really don't want to drop your phone.
No. Because then you can't unlock your phone.
it's going to be a repair gold mine.
Yeah, Apple. Yeah, it is.
Can I get into your phone? Well, that'll be $150 for a new piece of glass.
That is going to be where Apple moves to. Touch ID will go behind the glass. The home button will basically be reduced to a touch-sensitive 3D touch haptic feedback button, which will allow them to make that bottom lip much thinner because... If you have most of the bottom lip as a touch-sensitive button, quote-unquote, the target area is a lot larger than a physical button. Imagine there's just like a little home icon on that bottom glass there, and you just kind of tap anywhere around it, like press in anywhere around it, it vibrates,
mm-hmm.
gives feedback. Like that's a lot easier than a specific button
right in the
middle.
Yeah, I absolutely
so
agree with you there.
I think that's the tech that they're going to move to. Touch ID goes inside the screen. Home button becomes a 3D touch haptic button. No more moving parts there. They can make that lip thinner, reduce the bezels around the screen, and make a phone that still has quite a large screen. They might even increase the size of the screen. To 5 inches for this.
But none of this stuff we're talking about would happen for September this year, right?
It's actually quite possible.
I haven't actually, to be honest with you,
because I'll tell you.
I haven't seen any mock-ups, so.
As John Gruber has reported, yeah. And several analysts and things have corroborated this,
mm-hmm.
next year is the big iPhone redesign. The entire phone will change next year.
Well, why wouldn't we have that for an iPhone 7? Isn't this a
I'm gonna
is the tick or the talk the big change?
They're not doing that anymore.
So they're done with that.
I'm pretty sure they're done with that. Yeah.
Right. I guess the 6S was the whole start of that because that was a massive, even though the phone looked the same, like a massive redesign.
And
of the,
when they asked Tim Cook about it, he said, "Well, we're just going to release things when they're ready."
Right.
So. Tying that into the iPhone upgrade program that I believe will be rolled out to a lot more countries this year.
Yeah, we could certainly use that here in Canada.
You're basically going to end up with this infrastructure where people constantly get the new iPhone every year because they're paying like $50 a month and they just always have a new iPhone all the time. So Apple can basically go, well, we decided to just throw the kitchen sink into this one just because. Because all of these things that we've been working on are ready,
mm-hmm.
and all of those things will be ready next year.
Yeah,
it's not ready this year, unfortunately, but next year's phone is going to be quite something if the rumors are true. Basically, we're looking at a all-screen front with an OLED panel the entire thing. I've been calling it the infinity display, which would be fun if it's the iPhone 8, because the infinity symbol is a sideways 8.
Yeah. So what is the most likely design we're going to get in September?
So September, the back is the same, roughly.
Right.
The antenna lines have been cleaned up a bit. There's only one line on each, on the top and the bottom now, instead of two. So the line, the straight line across on each side is gone. And the one that curves with the phone, we think is going to be right on the edge of the chassis.
Right. So less visible just by looking directly at the back of it.
Yeah. So the entire back of the phone away from the edges will be a solid piece of aluminum.
Right. And I guess that would be due to the new liquid metal stuff, right?
No. That's, if that comes in, that'll be next year's phone.
Okay.
One thing they've supposedly been doing for the new phone is a new antenna assembly that allows them to bundle multiple chips into one array. To save space. There was an article about it today. I forget exactly.
Well, that totally makes sense. It falls in line with Apple's mentality of how do we miniaturize it even further?
Yeah,
They're obsessed with that.
So if they can get the antenna apparatus into something really small, then they only need that one line, because everything's just right there to come directly out of the line. So we know the back of the phone is pretty much the same as the 6S. But the one thing we have not seen, and I don't think we will see, is the front of the phone. And that's where I think the changes are going to come in for this year's phone. The back's going to be the same, but the front is going to be different. And what I think they're going to do, if next year's phone is all screen, no home button, no anything, just a screen. The entire thing is just a slab that is the entire display. If that's next year's, if that's 2017's phone, then this year's phone is a stepping stone between the 6S and that design. So in order to get to there from here, what needs to happen is Touch ID needs to move, and the home button needs to change and become something more like Android. Because if you're in the entire front of your phone mm-hmm. is a screen, then there's no more space for a button. So to get to there from the 6S, you put Touch ID inside the screen and you make a haptic feedback button that's still where the old button was. But so it's the new tech that they're eventually going to move into the screen, but it's still in a familiar place, so that people can kind of learn, like, okay, this is where the button was. Now it's this little icon, and if I press on the glass, it vibrates, and that's like a button press.
Right, okay.
Then from there, we move to the brand new phone, and it's just this virtual 3D touch button on the screen.
Interesting.
Kind of like Android.
Well, I know Apple has resisted that for so long, but it just seems inevitable now that we have to.
Yeah.
We have to go buttonless.
We do.
There are also too many mechanical potential issues with a button. They wear down.
At this point, the single largest point of failure on an iPhone is the home button. The maximum number of repairs, the maximum number of support calls, home button. So if they can kill the home button, the iPhone as a product is dramatically more stable and more reliable. So
now we need Touch ID on MacBooks, and I'm being completely serious about
this. I think we'll get that at some point too. They just need
to somehow integrate it into the glass touchpad.
Yeah. I think that'll probably be the most sensible thing. And if they're putting Touch ID inside the screen this year, I think it stands to reason that the
same
new MacBooks this year
are. Yeah.
Yeah. It'll be like Force Touch and then
sure.
3D Touch. Like they'll put it inside the trackpad, then they'll put it inside the iPhone, and it'll be like, yeah, this is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's definitely a better solution than my solution that I proposed, that the power button that's at the top right corner of the MacBook Pro just becomes the touch Touch ID button.
That was never going to happen.
But I knew that would never happen. Like, that was my initial thought.
And I know that Apple would never in a million years do what's done on Windows PCs, where it's this little like weird scan thing that you run your finger over. Like, I don't know if you've seen those on laptops, but there's weird things that you just run your finger over and it's supposed to scan it
right.
with a single line of IR.
That's crap.
They're terrible. They're absolutely terrible. I think the new version of Windows 10 is supporting like next gen biometric stuff. So if a laptop wants to have like a thing, it'll actually use something similar to what the Android phones are using these days, and you'll be able to just press your thumb on the pad and it'll read it. But
do you remember there was a product that Microsoft released? It feels like 10 years ago. It was a long time ago, before, might have been even before the iPhone.
Fingerprint reader?
It was a standalone, fingerprint reader that you plugged into a USB port or something.
Yep.
And it was like notoriously inaccurate and horrible.
I think that was released around the same time as Windows 7.
It wasn't even secure. There were so, like, it could so easily be bypassed.
Yeah.
It's just funny looking back on that biometric tech like from 10 years ago.
Oh yeah.
And how far we've come.
It's amazing the progress we've made. But yeah, I think the iPhone 7 this year, the changes are all going to be on the front. So the back will look mostly the same. People will be disappointed, but if the front looks how I think it's going to look, we'll all be pretty impressed. I also think that True Tone from the iPad Pro 9.7 inch will make its way into the iPhone. Probably.
That did not make it into the iPhone SE, right?
No. True Tone is a new tech that's exclusive to the iPad Pro 9.7 inch.
10-bit color?
Yep, that too. The 12-inch iPad Pro doesn't have either of those things. One thing I also think will make it to the iPhone 7 this year is the smart connector. I think we'll see a new battery case from Apple that'll directly connect to the smart connector on the new iPhone, and then the Lightning port will be free for other things. So they won't have to have all that bulk at the bottom of the phone. There'll just be a connector inside the case.
I'm trying to visualize the smart connector. I don't even know what it looks like.
Oh, sorry. Here, let me show you.
Michael's holding up his brand new 9.7 inch iPad.
So there are these three little circles on the side of the iPad.
I see it now.
And when something that supports the smart connector comes near it, it's kind of like the Surface. It'll just like sort of click into it magnetically. Yeah. And then that's for the keyboard. And you get power and data connectivity through that.
That's really nice.
It's effectively the same thing as a Lightning port. It's just this really unobtrusive thing that's on some part of the device and things can connect to it. There aren't a lot of accessories right now for it. In fact, there's literally only one third-party accessory, the Logitech Smart Keyboard.
So why don't we just replace the Lightning port with something like that? Or is, I guess that would be too weak of a... It's magnetic, right? Something could easily just come unclipped from it.
Yeah, it's essentially MagSafe for iOS. It's kind of the same principle, only there's data connectivity instead of just power.
It's interesting. I wonder if MacBook Pros would ever get something like that.
They could. It's not totally out of the realm of possibility. I think
that seems a little bit nicer than the older style ones that actually have to physically plug into, like, you know, like with these ones. Now this is a 5-year-old MacBook Pro that I'm looking at, but the new ones are not that different. And like with these ones, I always find that like I never quite get them quite. They never snap in place quite properly the first time.
Yeah.
So sometimes you have to kind of wiggle it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think a lot of these innovations are going to slowly start to work their way through the product line. Like all of this stuff in the iPad Pro, it's going to come to iPhone. It's going to come to Mac. Like all of this stuff is just going to cycle through everything else. So I think this year's iPhone will probably have the smart connector. I think we're hopefully going to start to see more accessories that use it for the iPad. And then for the iPhone, I think battery cases will definitely be hugely innovated with the smart connector because...
Well, they need more colors. They got to do more colors for the battery case.
Yeah.
White and charcoal gray?
The charcoal is quite nice, but yeah.
It's all right.
I don't know.
I just don't understand Apple's deal. Like, why? We used to have these amazing colorful iMacs and they've gone away from that. Now, well, it feels like they slowly started to like bring some of that back with the new rose gold now with
yeah.
the iPhone.
I mean the physical device colors, yeah, they're kind of trying to inject more color. I will never buy those colors until they have black glass on the front, but that's me. I think they're probably going to have to do black glass anyway.
Why?
OLED. When they move to OLED, it's going to be black glass or bust, essentially. Because with OLED, the illusion that you want to create is that the screen is this seamless pool inside the glass, much like the Apple Watch is right now.
And like, definitely not like my iPhone 6, my white iPhone 6,
yes.
where I can see a black border, a thin black border separating the screen from the edge.
Yep. Which we will never tire of reminding our listeners of.
No.
It cannot be unseen.
That's the same deal on the 6S, right?
Yeah.
They didn't change that.
They have not fixed that.
Do you think
ever.
They're going to do anything with that on the 7?
I think when the 8 moves to OLED, like I said, black glass is the only thing that makes sense there because then you've got this perfectly seamless display that just melts into the glass.
Right.
And it looks... Because with OLED, when pixels are black, they are off. There is no light being emitted from them. So... If you have black glass and an OLED display, you basically cannot tell the difference between the screen and the glass. There is absolutely no difference. So I think honestly, from a practical standpoint, it won't make sense to have white glass anymore at that point. Just because it'll break the illusion.
Yeah.
At which point I will get a black and rose gold phone because that's going to look really awesome.
Do you honestly like the way the rose gold looks? I think it looks better on the SE just because
yeah.
of the lack of those antenna lines and it's just one solid slab of that color.
Yeah, I don't mind it. I think maybe the gold is a little nicer. I think the rose gold could stand to be a little less pink than it is. Because rose gold, actual rose gold is more copper in color.
Sure, sure.
So, I mean, if we want to be accurate about it, it's a little too pink to be rose gold.
Well, you know, the color of it really reminds me of a rosé wine.
Yeah.
Where it is very pink.
Yeah. It is more like a rosé wine, just like the gold is more like a champagne.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. I don't mind the gold, actually.
No, the gold does look quite nice, but yeah, white glass, nope. Can't do it. So this year should prove interesting because if all I have prophesied comes to pass, then... 2017's iPhone is going to really be something.
Well, there's always something better around the corner. It just remains to be seen whether or not you can justify upgrading.
Yeah.
Like, I'm still on an iPhone 6. So
but of course.
Depending on how drastic this design change is, that will determine whether or not I actually upgrade to the 7.
Hmm.
Or whether I will skip two whole generations. Will I?
Yeah.
Now, the problem is, you know what? Actually, this phone functionally works fine. But what I have to live with day in and day out, and Michael's looking at it right now, is a bent and slightly curved iPhone 6.
Yeah.
It certainly is a first world problem, though, isn't it?
Yeah, a little bit. But hey, they fixed it. So it's not going to happen again at any rate.
I've been told that the iPhone SE does not use the stronger 7000 series aluminum?
It does not, no.
But I suppose it does not need it because it has that extra thickness.
Exactly.
And it's a smaller phone.
It's literally
really
the
hard
same,
to bend that.
It's literally the same chassis as the 5S. They just didn't diamond polish the camphors.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I think is an improvement.
It is a slight
those things scratched so badly. Like my 5S, by the time I got my 6, those edges were just raw.
Yeah,
they were just completely messed up.
Well, especially because you and I don't like to use cases. So when you drop those things on the ground, they get horribly scuffed up.
Yeah. But I mean, for mine, I use cases. So for mine, it was just literally putting it in a case, taking it out of a case. Just that ended up scratching the camphors. That's how bad it was. So I'm really glad that the whole thing is just matte polished. Just looks a lot cleaner.
Yeah.
So yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens this year. I think probably the bigger thing this year is going to be iOS 10 and the changes to the App Store. Supposedly Phil Schiller, now that he's in charge, has been actively seeking the opinion of app developers for what they want to see happen with the App Store. So I feel like at WWDC, we may see some significant improvements, not only for app developers, but also people that buy and use apps as well. I think we'll see a lot of quality of life improvements for the App Store.
We have to. We just have to.
Yeah.
With all the complaints and people leaving the App Store.
I think just the fact that Phil Schiller has been put in charge of this telegraphs that Apple is basically saying,
No doubt.
We get it. We're going to fix this. Like, that's what that says. By making him in charge of the whole thing, it's like, we understand there's a problem.
It just takes
time.
We are
fixing it. Yeah. So WWDC, I think, is the first indicator we'll see of those changes. And iOS 10, I think, is going to be huge for iPad in particular.
Yeah.
Because now we have these amazing iPad Pros that are nearly as powerful as a laptop. So I think iOS can finally spread its wings a little more with that horsepower.
You've been listening to The Impromptu on Hologram Radio. I am here with Michael Norton, as always. If you'd like to show your support for our show and the network, it would be greatly appreciated. You can do that, and there's a couple of ways to support it by going to patreon.com/hologramradio and donate a buck or two, whatever you feel comfortable with parting. That would sincerely be appreciated since we are entirely listener-supported. You can also go to hologramradio.org/sponsors and shop at Amazon through our Amazon affiliate banner links. And please do that if you do shop at Amazon like most of us do these days, and you're going to buy something off of your wish list, just use our links. We've got links for Amazon UK, USA, and Canada. There's no additional work needed on your part, so head to that page and click those links. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes to ensure you get every new episode each and every week. And if you're in iTunes, why not leave us a comment or drop a rating in there? That helps new people find the show. I know we ask for that every week, but it's been a while since we've had a review, and it really does make a difference. So please take a moment to do that. And I'll just say, if you listen to other podcasts, really make the effort to leave a review. I've been trying to do that, more of that myself lately. I know it's annoying because not all of us use the iTunes app, so you got to open up another app just to leave a review. And I really wish Apple would do something about that. But since that's all we're able to do at this point, you got to do it. You can follow the show on Twitter. We're at The Impromptu. You can hit up Michael at Zen Impulse or myself at Zero Distraction. Follow the network on Facebook at Hologram Radio. Actually, sorry, it's facebook.com/hologramradio. On Instagram, Hologram Radio Shows, and check out some of the other great shows on the network. We've got technology podcasts. We have podcasts on writing and books and the process of writing and interviews, and there's something for everyone there. You can also email us the old-fashioned way, theimpromptu@hologramradio.org. That's theimpromptu@hologramradio.org. And Michael and I both receive those emails.
And on that note, thanks for listening, everyone. See you next time.